This is KUT,
Austin.
Stop. I used to get mad at my school. Teachers had taught me when cool. They're holding me down, turning me around, filling me up with your rules. I have to admit, it's getting better, a little better, all the time. Hello. And welcome to Higher Ed, KUT's podcast focusing on issues of higher education, lifelong learning, and exercising the brain. I'm Jennifer Staton with KUT 90.5, Austin's NPR station, talking as always with Dr. Ed Berger, president of Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas. Hello, Ed.
Hello, Jennifer. How are you today?
Well, I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
Actually, I think I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to have you on our campus and just to be able to have another conversation about whatever it is we're going to talk about.
Well, I feel the same way, although I feel a little badly because this episode has some sad components to it. I will just tell you up front.
Okay. You know, people do often ask me, are these scripted? And I wonder, are they listening to these things? How could they possibly be scripted? These are live.
No, I will create a topic and then we will just take it from there.
That's right.
But, you know, it was occurring to me, Ed, because I work at a newsroom. I'm surrounded by news all the time. And I was sort of reflecting back on the past, you know, few months and thinking we had Hurricane Harvey that really impacted mm-hmm. Texas. Hurricane Irma really hit Florida. Hurricane Maria made its way, you know, through the islands. The terrible earthquake in Mexico. All of those things happened, you know, relatively early in a school year, but they all happened during a school year. And I started thinking, there can really be outside forces that can be very disruptive to that regularity, the rhythm, the schedule of a school year. And I thought it might be useful to talk about that because it also got me thinking, you know, there can be disruption on a large scale like that, you know, sadly, a natural disaster when something happens, but also for an individual student or for a teacher, you know, an illness or a death in the family, something that really can kind of disrupt the rhythm. And, you know, we often talk about issues that sort of presuppose a smooth, easy path through the school year. And we can talk about the issues that come out of education. But let's talk a little bit today about what happens when that is all kind of disrupted and you don't have that smooth and easy path.
Yeah. And I will tell you that even at a school that is as intimate as Southwestern, we have about, you know, 1,500 students. About every year, we will often lose a student because of some issue like that. A parent becomes very, very ill, or that student becomes ill. And you know, so imagine now at some of these, you know, ridiculously large institutions, they're constantly having those things on the individual level. What's a little bit stranger is to have some global thing, like you're mentioning these awful natural disasters. And for Southwestern, Hurricane Harvey was particularly impactful. We have about 40% of our student body is coming from the Texas coast somewhere, give or take, you know, going in a little bit.
Wow, so that's what, 600 or 700?
That's a lot of students. And about 30% are coming from the greater metro Houston area. So it was very disconcerting. Going back to the beginning of this academic year, our first years come back a week before the upper class folks. And so they were already on campus. So all the first years were moved in. The weekend that Hurricane Harvey hit was the weekend that the upper class folks were supposed to move in. And so what we did was we actually opened up our doors earlier and said, anyone who wants to come back early and to try to actually avoid that, this storm that's impending, you can come back. And a bunch of students did come up. But some students were actually stranded and couldn't get to campus. And so we had to make special accommodations for them for missing the first few days of class. But I think it's the emotional toll that's most important. Even if you didn't have family or friends connected with that directly, just watching that, thinking about that, it was very, and remains, very distressing. And many students, after the storm, went down to Houston and to the coast to help. Many faculty and staff went down to help through various organizations and groups. The students started a emergency fund here at Southwestern to help other students or families of students who needed financial assistance. And so it's an opportunity to try to help. And so when you think of it that way, it ends up being a kind of uplifting thing. And we saw those uplifting stories where people said, boy, you see the best in people when something really awful like this happens. And that, I suppose, is a tiny silver lining. It certainly doesn't help those families that lost their homes and possessions, but it shows that there's goodness amongst us.
After an event like Hurricane Harvey or in Mexico, like we saw the earthquake, when things start getting back to, and it's not anywhere near normal, but when routines start being reestablished, how can teachers or administrators help students get back their focus? Because as you say, the emotional toll in some ways is kind of the most prominent one. And I imagine that for weeks and months, students are still upset and distracted and worried. How do you kind of restore a good, you know, learning environment so that students can still have somewhat of a regular school year experience?
I think encouraging people to see what can we learn and how can we individually and collectively be better is a positive way to frame it. But also it's a mindset and a practice of living, which is bad things will happen. And they will happen to us on both levels, as you suggest, at the individual and personal level, you know, the familial level, and also at the global level. So we can't bury our heads in the sand, and that's not a good education just to say kind of, oh, don't worry about that. But the question is, how do you move to be effective from that? How can you make the world better after something like that? How can you try to mitigate that from happening again? And how can we see a positive way forward from something that could be disastrous? And I think that that's a mindset that can be taught and can be practiced. And that should be part of one's formal education so that you can live a fulfilled life as you face adversity that is inevitable.
Yeah, certainly it's an opportunity to demonstrate and teach students some things that may not necessarily come up in the course of the year. I mean, resilience comes to mind.
Yes.
You know, usually resilience in a classroom, it might be how do you deal with a bad grade or a lost homework assignment, not something as large scale and catastrophic as a hurricane or earthquake. But I guess it is a kind of extraordinary in every sense of the word teaching and learning opportunity.
That's right. And I think resilience is the perfect word, by the way. That's exactly right.
All right. So, Ed, I want to got my little visual cheat sheet here. I want to go back and take a look at our puzzler from last time.
Oh, the visual cheat sheet. Now I understand. I know what you meant. This was tricky.
Challenging.
It was tricky. Let me remind our listeners, because this one, I upped the ante here.
You did.
I put a little caffeine in this particular puzzler. Let me just remind them what it is, and then we can talk about it a little bit.
Okay.
So imagine that you have a 6x6 checkerboard. So a square that's divided, you know, six squares on each side. So you have 36 squares in all. And you're going to start in the square that's positioned in the uppermost left corner. And your goal is to move either to the right or down and one square at a time, one adjacent square at a time, and not diagonally. And the goal is to get to the a lowermost right corner, so diagonally opposite from where you started. But you're only able to go one adjacent square at a time, and you can't backtrack. So you can't, you know, go down, for example, one of the sides and then go back up. You have to continue to get closer to your destination. So you can either go to the right or you can go down, and that's it. And the question was, how many different ways are there to traverse this 6x6 square to go from one corner to the opposite?
And as I recall, your hint was to go back to those rules of effective thinking.
Yes. And buy my book. Is that
rude?
Will
that help me solve the puzzler?
Well, if you can read it really fast, we have to give the answer in a matter of seconds here.
Well, what occurred to me is, so I sort of tried to go for kind of something that seems straightforward and simple. So I did not sit here and trace every path from one corner to the other corner. But I started looking at what that might look like. And I thought, well, there's some obvious ones, like across the top and down the side.
So, that's one.
But then I started thinking, but then it's this and then it's that. And I realized there are a lot of possible pathways here.
And that's the correct answer. There are a lot.
Okay. But you probably are looking for a specific number.
If we can, but that's a good start.
So I started thinking it's probably something, I'm thinking, formula-based, and it's something based on, you know, how many squares across we can start from and how many up and down. So I'm thinking that it's something like, you know, 5 times 6, 30, or 6 times 6, 36, or double 36, 72. I'm thinking that the answer can be found in some kind of formula that of area or something like that. I don't have a specific number, but that's where my thinking was going of using sort of the squares and just being able to tell that there are a lot of possibilities, that there's probably a quicker way than drawing every single one.
Yeah, of course. And and your thinking is right on target, I'd say. I reminded everyone that they should try to understand simple things deeply, not do the whole thing at once, and then also look for a pattern. And that's what you're suggesting. Mm-hmm. The pattern, I think, is in some sense, is simpler than what you're suggesting, but actually is more subtle. So there's not like a quick little formula for it.
Yeah.
So let me see if I can talk it through you and maybe our listeners as well. So imagine being in that upper left position.
Okay.
Now, how many choices do you have there?
Well, you mean to start?
Correct.
You've only got two choices.
Correct. You can either go to the right or you could go down. Okay. So imagine if we now just, in each square, write how many different ways there are to get to just that square. So, for example, to the square one unit over from where we started, there's only one way to get there.
There's only one, yeah.
And the square that's adjacent but down from our starting square, there's only one way. So we'd write one in each of those things. Now let's take a look at the square that's diagonal to our starting position. How many ways are there to get there?
There are two.
That's right. Because you could have either gone to the right first.
And down one.
Or.
Down one and across one.
Correct. So now let's put a two in that square.
Got it.
Okay.
Oh, I think I see where you're
Now let's just do a little bit more. Let's just take a moment to do a little bit more. Let's now imagine going across. So starting back at where we original starting position. And now going across three squares over. So, you know, not the one we just were at.
Right.
But now one beyond that. How many ways are there to get there?
Well, so you could go across and down.
No. Just across. I want to go three over.
Oh, one way.
One
just
way.
Straight across.
Just go one, go to that next square adjacent, and then the next square adjacent. There's only one way to
one
do that.
One way, right.
And what about if we go back to the starting position in the corner and want to go down?
One way.
One way, because we go to the, you'd pass that first square we'd get to, and then the next square. Now, let's take a look. Okay, this is now hard to visualize. But imagine you wanted to get to three over to the right and one down.
Well, now you've got some more options.
Right.
Now the numbers start adding up a little more.
Right.
Because you could go to the right and down.
Correct.
Multiple spaces.
Right.
Or you could go only one over.
Yep.
And then down.
Right.
And then over.
Right.
Or you could go down.
Right.
And then over and over.
So how many ways is that?
Three.
And the answer is three. So now write a three. And I loved what you said. You said now it's adding up.
Ah, yeah.
Now take a look. If you take a look, visualize this, you'll see that you have a one and a one flanking that initial starting point.
Yep.
And then the square that's kind of nestled in between them has a two.
Uh-huh.
And now if you take a look at the one on the far right and then kind of flanking that beneath it is the two, when you add those two numbers, you get three.
Get three. So there's a pattern.
There's a pattern, which is that you have to add the two adjacent horizontal.
Oh, this is so cool.
I'm sorry, the two adjacent diagonal ones to get the square that's next to it, which makes sense when you think about it. Because if you're looking at a particular square, you could either come from it from above or from the right. And so if you know how many ways there are to get to the one above and you know how many ways there are to get to the right, then if you add those two up, those are the number of ways to get to that square.
It really becomes almost an arithmetic.
It's just an addition question. You fill up this thing and the numbers do get big. So you're right about that. And if you actually write this down, and those of you who know a little bit about some math, you'll recognize that what you're actually producing is part of what's called the Pascal's triangle.
This sounds vaguely familiar.
Yes. And then it takes a turn when the square starts to come in. When you reach that large diagonal, then it starts to kind of diminish again. It changes. But you do all of that addition, lots of addition.
Yes. What do you get?
You want to take a guess? Think out a number. Order of magnitude. Now that you see the pattern, just make a guess.
Well, okay, it's going to be in the hundreds. Couple of hundred?
That's exactly right. Couple of hundred is an excellent guess. The actual answer is 252.
Wow.
Well done. Now, that was a hard one. No one's going to complain that was too easy.
But it was also very fun.
Yeah. And if you draw a picture of it, and again, look for the simple things, focus on that and search for a pattern, all of a sudden the answer is clear. If you're thinking about, I've got to figure out every single path, and there's so many of them, it becomes overwhelming. So always seek structure.
Ed, well, thank you for helping us seek structure and help keep our brain sharp. Dr. Ed Berger is president of Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas. You can find out more at southwestern.edu. And you can keep your brain busy by keeping up with the news and other episodes of Higher Ed at KUT.org. You can find Higher Ed also on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jennifer Staton, KUT News.